It's Ouch, the show that likes to confront the awkwardness around disability. I'm Kate.
And I'm Rob. Coming up, an old Chinese proverb says the way to health leads not through the pharmacy, but through the kitchen. We'll be talking to a blogger who has thrown away her prescription drugs and now uses organic plant-based food instead. But why and how?
Earlier this year, a young man with schizoaffective disorder put out media messages to help find Mike, the man who stopped him jumping off Waterloo Bridge when he was at his lowest. Well, it's just won recognition for best campaign. We'll be talking about the significance of that and how social media was used later.
The quiz is back and we're playing out with a country music track from a 70-year-old blind woman. It's called Blindness Gets Tedious, Don't It? Don't go away now.
Ouch! Disability Talk from the BBC with Rob Crossan and Kate Monaghan.
Thanks to Simon and Shannon for keeping our seats warm last month, but now you're back with the A-team.
They weren't bad.
They were all right. Not as good as us.
No, I'll tell you, it was nice this morning.
Don't say they're good or we could get replaced for good, you know?
Yeah, but I felt reassured this morning when we went through BBC, the phalanx of police, the screaming mob. We missed you, Rob. And then there was a few others. Saying,
I know,
just a few
the paparazzi were crazy.
Yeah, I mean, PC Plod, you know, wiping a little single tear from his eye. They were so happy to have us back, so it's been reassuring.
They were, and it is lovely to be back with show number 112 with Disability Talk, whatever that is, for the next 55 minutes.
Yeah, I love the fact we've got to issue 112. And we still don't know what Disability Talk is. We'll get back to you when we've figured that out. And we've got three people sitting around the table today. So let's introduce them one by one. One man who does a lot of talking is sitting in front of me on Audio Boo in his podcasts. He goes by the name of Gabriel McBird and he reviews food and, as a blind person, how accessible he finds the service at restaurants. Hello, Gabriel.
Hello.
Right, we're going to be feeding you, but hopefully not forcibly or through a tube. It will be entirely voluntary a little bit later. But here's a taste of Gabriel's audio reviews. We join him right now while he's being a little more quiet than usual, reviewing food in the restaurant car of a train.
Hello, it's Gabriel McBird here. I trained to Newport. They call it Travelling Chef. I was going to try a gourmet burger. However, they wanted £9 for it, and that was just a burger, so forget that.
Are these meals? Because they don't sound as though they come with anything.
No, not really. Not with you should order chips or fries.
Yeah,
or...
I think that's a bit. Yeah, we feel a bit ripped off when you get that kind of thing. You don't even get a side with it.
The price doesn't include that. So...
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It should do really, but anyway.
I did, however, get bacon sausage baguette, which still came to about just over a £5, but at least it's good quality. And unusually and rather pleasantly, it's a bit of good, thick, smoked bacon.
But basically, for a big, you know, quite a hearty soup, excuse me, the bell shouldn't fly there, and I'll just eat it too quickly. For a hearty soup, it's reasonable, it's reasonable considering it's on a railway station.
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to read A.A. Gill's restaurant reviews in the Sunday Times in quite the same way after hearing that. I mean, these aren't even really guerrilla-style restaurant reviews. And you are right, I think charging extra for side dishes is both sick and wrong on
such
many levels.
Such a bugbear.
So Gabriel will be with us for the whole show and throughout the programme. We'll be giving him more food to review.
Also with us is Natasha Lipman. She has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, a significant arthritic condition to manage and one that I know well, being a fellow EDSer myself. But this year she's given up all her prescription drugs in favour of treating herself with food. I am fascinated by this one. And she's been blogging and Instagramming about it all since May. Now, Natasha, we'll be talking to you in more depth about this in 20 minutes, but your diet is now very different to the average person, is that right?
Yeah, I have a meat-free, dairy-free, gluten-free, refined sugar-free, rotation, caffeine-free, alcohol-free, no processed food diet.
Okay.
But it was also, I changed my diet not because of the EDS, it was because I developed POTS and histamine intolerance last year.
Right. So just to give us a little glimpse of what that kind of diet could be like, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
I had a litre of green juice. Which I'm seeing.
A litre?
Oh, yes. Gosh. Because I make a litre of it, so I might as well just drink it.
It actually makes me feel sick, the idea of drinking a litre of green.
And what are the primary ingredients of said green liquid?
Cucumber, broccoli, apple, parsley, coriander, mint, fennel. Nice. It is really nice.
I've had juice from friends who make it, except the one that she made me had chili and ginger in it. But
that's also really good for you.
Mm. Wow. That doesn't, like, you know, okay. I'm not saying I want a liter of it, but yeah, I don't feel repelled by the idea.
They're actually everyone that's had them before, when I've given them to them, except my mother, who is terrified of it. They always say it's actually really nice.
There you go. Yeah, I know. And also, last time he was on the show, we dubbed him the Brian Cox of mental health, for which we really just can't stop apologising. But he's back again. It's Mark Brown. He was the editor of One in Four magazine, which is a mental health glossy, which is apparently no more. You're now focusing your time on social media, you digital hero, you.
Yeah, sort of. I'm sort of focusing my time on shooting my mouth off about mental health, predominantly, and social media is usually easier to arrange than getting in a room with people and shooting my mouth off at them. But yeah, unfortunately, we sadly did have to put One in Four to bed because there wasn't any money.
Mm. You mean just the advertising?
There's never been any advertising money, mainly because people don't want to advertise things to people with mental health difficulties. We're not enough of a market as far as people see. So, and there's still, unfortunately, a kind of taint and a kind of stigma.
Which, when, as you said, one in four of the British public have a form of,
absolutely,
mental illness or condition, then it seems even more extraordinary, doesn't it? But that is why we are here, people.
Anyway, one more voice is that of Kathleen Hawkins, who's with us for Ouch News. And you may think that Ouch is run solely by myself and Rob alone, and that is almost completely true. However, there are one or two people in the background of the Ouch team, and Kathleen is one of those, and we're happy to say hello to you today. And what are you doing in the studio?
Hello. Well, I'm here to go through what's coming up in the next month, what you can expect from Ouch, what's in the Disability News Diary.
Amazing. So what exciting
treats.
Oh, you are
a social diarist now.
She is, yeah. She plans our parties.
You sort of plum sites of disability. Okay.
So what is coming up then? What have we got to look forward to?
Well, I think the main thing in the news is going to be the sentencing of Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius. He's going to be sentenced over the death of his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, and it's due to happen on the 13th of October. Now, Pistorius may have escaped murder charges, but the judge's decision to convict him of culpable homicide means he still faces up to 15 years in prison.
Wow.
We're going to be watching this closely at Ouch. We're really interested to see whether or not the judge takes into consideration his disability when she's making this sentencing. She did take it into consideration throughout the trial. BBC's Milton Nkosi, who's the Johannesburg correspondent, he said to me that it was crucial in the verdict. It was used in the defence's argument that because he grew up as a double amputee, this led to him developing a generalised anxiety disorder. Now, it's because of this high level of anxiety that led to him hearing an intruder. We now know that it's not an intruder, but the judge believed him, which was a crucial part in the verdict. So we'll be watching closely on the 13th to find out what happens to Oscar. Now, also coming up, bit lighter news.
Good, because that is pretty heavy.
Yeah, we're going to be looking forward to an exhibition. Now, it's been conceived by Dada Fest, which we all know and love here on Ouch, and it includes a film about the vacuum cleaner who was on Ouch.
We love the
Ouch podcast a couple of months ago. And that's a self-made film about a mental health institution. A self-made mental health institution, not a self-made film, although it is that as well.
Okay.
Now
this is the institution that he was talking about when he was on the podcast
absolutely.
A few months ago.
Yeah, and I think the film has been reworked for this exhibition, so that's quite exciting.
He turned his bedroom into a mental institution,
didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Fantastic.
And also, there's going to be a 19th century acoustic chair. Now, this is possibly the world's first hearing aid. And there's also going to be a hearing aid from the 50s worn by the singer Johnny Ray. And also another Ouch favourite, there's going to be a new show from Lawrence Clark there as well.
Oh, good old Lawrence.
Our friend Lawrence. And what? So Dada, they were the people who had a stage at Glastonbury, didn't they? Is that right?
There wasn't a stage at Glastonbury, a disability stage at Glastonbury this year. And it's weird.
But there have been in previous
years. It's weird that you might know more about this than us.
Well, it's one of the
that
few occasions.
Happens.
Yeah, I know. Admittedly, it's still quite sketchy in certain respects, but I feel at least you're looking at me with sort of confusion rather than pity. which is
so
nice.
So what else is going on?
Answer to Gabriel's question, the exhibition will be in Liverpool. Okay. What else? It's that time of year ago. Students are going back to university, and on Ouch we're gearing up for our Students' Week at the end of October. We're going to be following two disabled students, Molly and Fran, as they go off to university for the first time. There's going to be videos and articles, and we'll be finding out how they're adapting to life at university.
So how did we find Molly and Fran?
Kate,
the joys of social media.
Oh, did you select?
Yeah,
you selected
they
them.
Got in touch, and we're calling for more of that throughout the Students' Week. We want people to get in touch, ex-students, present students, find out how they're getting on, how they adapted to life away from home, the independence that comes with university.
And it is an extremely difficult time if you're a young man or woman making that step. You know, the accessibility requirements is a very psychological
and
emotionally
sorting out DSA.
It
can take a long time.
The endless
karaoke. Bureaucratic.
The horrible side of
cuts and DSA take effect yet, although not till next year.
Not this year, no. But there's a lot going on, and it's difficult enough, I think, becoming a student. If you throw a disability into the mix there, it makes it even harder. Yeah. But that will all be on the website, not on the podcast. So make sure you keep checking back to bbc.co.uk/ouch for more information.
And thank you, Social Diarist.
Yeah, right.
You are welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
And Gabriel, who you heard interjecting just then, and Natasha and Mark, who were being very well behaved and quiet, are still with us. Now, Gabriel, this is the moment which I believe you've probably come here for. We have some food for you to try at this juncture.
The rustling of a
brown bag. The rustling of the bag. The rather scuffed-looking brown bag Kate is about to remove. Now, what we have here is a standard-issue BBC breakfast bacon roll. So can you tuck in then,
sort
Gabriel?
Sort of thing that would probably bring an arthritis burst on immediately. Because...
Initial thoughts?
I can certainly recognise the bacon. I'd say, you know, it's not been short of a little grease. Just
I'm gonna tuck into the other half of this.
Oh, have you got one as well? Why didn't I get one?
Yeah, you don't get one.
Why don't I get one?
Because Damon gave it to me, not you, because I'm his favourite.
Damon, producer. Fine. Yeah, thank you. Natasha is going to offer me some healthy food later on, so I'm going to live longer than
both. That does sound good, actually.
Now, I like the way Gabriel's looking quite serene, holding his bacon roll at quite a noble angle. He so clearly has experience. And you're actually getting through that at an incredible rate.
Being gentle with it.
Yeah, the overall verdict then, before we move on, is...
I've certainly had worse. The bacon is a little greasy. The sausage, while perhaps being slightly mushy, has a very... quite a nice herby sort of taste about it, a little bit like stuffing.
I'd agree with that.
No one asked you. Marked out of 10.
It is better than your basic greasy spoon calf. I think it's probably worth a 7, though.
Gabriel, I mean, when you deliver your reviews, you know, while sitting in restaurants, often in front of the waiter or waitress, you know, I mean, do you think that being blind helps you get away with doing this, with always doing your reviews face-to-face with the staff?
I think it possibly does. I mean, often my reviews aren't face-to-face with the staff. I mean, there might be in a restaurant where, you know, but the staff aren't near the table and it's quite busy, so the staff are probably unlikely to hear it. Only a few are face-to-face. And I think if you can try and be honest with people... no one, whatever it is, likes to be told, look, this is just crap. But if something isn't as good as you'd want, if you can explain why, ideally people should find that useful feedback. I think the problem is that in this country in particular, the way we serve food isn't about serving people something that they'd like, something that someone's taken time to make. It's what can we provide at the cheapest price that will do.
And how does this relate to your blindness? I mean, what is good service for a blind person at a restaurant or cafe? I mean, you have to get people to read the entire menu.
You have to get, and quite often getting people to read that menu is it can be quite a sticky experience, because sometimes it can be a language issue where, you know, just no one speaks any English at all, and it's, you know, you then just have, you know, you have to admit defeat sometimes, because you aren't necessarily going to get what you want.
And it's a huge problem, I suppose, you can't see the menu and you can't understand the person reading you the menu.
And I mean, this is also for me, who, you know, I should eat more healthily because I like healthy food, but you know, I like unhealthy food as well. But, you know, if there's a, you know, the person with real allergies, severe reactions to food, you know, they, I think in a lot of places they're going to find it very difficult to get the waiters, the serving staff, to really engage. There's not only a language communication problem, but the people who work in these places don't have to know much about what they sell.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm particularly interested that I suppose in a past life you were an access to work assessor. Mm. So you're helping to determine what support people need in the workplace, and mm. you were visiting people in their offices, and so you obviously found your way into quite a lot of these work canteens. Mm. So which profession eats the best? And the worst.
Oh, I'd say the police eat the best.
Oh, do they?
Okay. Yeah.
Is there a lot of call for access to work at the police stations?
Well, as well as blind people, I assess people with dyslexia. And there are a lot of people trying to qualify the police who are dyslexic, which it can present problems because sometimes it can play to really is about playing to people's weaknesses, to the things they find most difficult. But yeah, there are quite a few dyslexic police.
But dyslexic police who eat well?
Well, it seems that the canteen have a lot of homemade food. Some of the worst food to be found is actually in the hospitals.
No surprises.
And sometimes people bang on a lot about healthy food, and some might argue that even the health police. Where they do have people do have a point. I think it's unacceptable that in places like leisure centres and hospitals that what you then get is processed rubbish food. I mean, these are places that should be leading by example. Mm. Clearly, it's unacceptable that you can go to a gym somewhere and all there is outside the gym is a machine selling chocolate bars and crisps. It just makes no sense.
I mean, you're sitting in front of you here with a sausage and bacon sandwich, which you are still eating your way through and clearly enjoying. But we've got Natasha with us, who's sitting in front of her with a lovely decorated jar of brown balls with sort of seeds on them. What is that?
They're balls that are just made with date seeds, flax. They've got raw chocolate in them, unprocessed.
Ooh, chocolate.
There's unprocessed chocolate in there.
Now I'm interested.
Yes.
So we've both got Ehlers-Danlos syndrome.
Yes.
We probably come at this from completely different angles because I am all about the drugs. I love my drugs. I love painkillers. I love anti-inflammatories. I love all of that kind of stuff. So what made you stop taking your drugs?
I've been thinking a lot about this recently, and first of all, for the EDS, painkillers just didn't work. They didn't do anything for me, and so there wasn't much point in taking them for no reason. It's not good for your system. So I stopped taking painkillers quite a long time ago. And then last year when I got the POTS and the histamine intolerance, I was put on so many different medications, and I get very idiosyncratic side effects that none of the doctors have heard about. And I've got lasting effects from one of the drugs that I was put on, and I've had some really uncomfortable and unpleasant side effects.
What's POTS?
POTS is postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially my body doesn't regulate itself properly.
Right. Okay.
And last year I stopped being able to eat. I couldn't really function at all.
When you say can't eat, you mean you found the taste of all food so disgusting you didn't want to, or you just couldn't process or digest
I couldn't anything? Process the food. It would take me 2-3 days to recover from half a banana. I lost a lot of weight that was my silver lining. That was the only thing that made me a bit happy at the time, but everyone else was really worried about me. I was just taking more and more medication, and being ill my whole life, I'd always been, I need someone to make me better. I will take any drug, I will have any operation, I will do anything. I just want to be better.
Yeah, that's my opinion too.
But there isn't enough research, there isn't enough, the doctors don't know really what to do. With the EDS, they send you to pain management, which made me more depressed, and that's when they put me on antidepressants, which then gave me PTSD.
PTSD is post-traumatic
stress disorder, and I've still suffer from that, and it was caused by medication.
So tell me about your diet then. How did you discover this diet? How did you find, you know, the foods that worked, and do they really help as much as the painkillers?
Well, the painkillers didn't work for me, and I think the reason I changed my diet wasn't to help with the pain, although I have seen an improvement apart from the last week where I've had a bit of a relapse. But last year, I couldn't eat. I was having the worst side effects. I was just so ill. And then I got really miserable over Christmas and was like, screw it, if I can't eat anyway, I'm going to eat everything and make myself even more unwell. So I was eating absolutely everything I could get my hands on, and it was very bad.
So what is it you do eat then?
I eat fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and grains. And actually, you can get a lot of food from that, and you can do a lot with it. I started researching in January, and I spent months just on Google. And at first, I kind of just came across general healthy food. And then I came across someone called Yasmina, who's the low histamine chef, and she was talking about histamine intolerance. And when I was first reading about histamine intolerance, which was severe allergic reactions to a lot of foods, there are just all these lists that say you shouldn't eat this, 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 and this, but eat everything else. So according to some of my doctors, I couldn't eat an avocado, mushrooms, or tomatoes, but I could still eat processed food. And that, to me, just didn't make sense. And so I started doing more research, and I thought, okay, well, natural foods have to be very good for me. Let's just cut out all of the rubbish and see what happens. And I started seeing a difference within a few months. It was amazing.
Wow.
Do you put quite a lot of it down to the psychological implications of, you know, you suddenly feel as if you're, it's not so much the food, it's more your feelings about eating these kind of foods that might be just as beneficial as the food itself, if that makes sense.
There is a really powerful mental element to it when you feel like you're actually taking control of something that you felt out of control of your whole life. I know people who've got mental health issues who have started changing the way they eat because it's giving them something else to focus on as well. And a lot of people who have had eating disorders find this way of eating as a really important part of their recovery. But as much of a part as that plays, I feel like the actual I can feel the benefits of the food.
I just want to turn for a second to Mark and just say, is this a sensible thing for people with mental health problems to sort of think about giving up the drugs in favour of diet?
It's really weird in mental health because there's sort of some things that people know about mental health, the ideas that float around. And one of them is that there's a massive conspiracy on the part of the pharma companies to stuff drugs down everyone's neck. And the other one is that if you just eat kale, your schizophrenia will disappear. And it's the kind of thing that people always say to you. It's like, you explain to someone, I've had a mental health difficulty for 10, 15 years, and they go, well, have you considered an organic diet? And it's the kind of thing they pull out of the bag, and then they get really sad, and they sort of tear up, and you go, oh, shut up. And I think I really agree with what you were saying about the thing about control, because like when you have a long-term condition, the one thing that you do feel is that kind of, you're in the lap of the gods a bit about whether things work or not. And medication's kind of scary because it's like in mental health, actually the people who make the medication don't really know how it works. And for some people it does work, some people it doesn't work. And there's something about people feeling like you really want to take control of things, you really want to be moving along the spectrum from being really unwell to being well. But I think when you're really, really sort of in the doldrums about your own health or your own condition, it makes you kind of quite uniquely susceptible to quackery.
Yeah.
And I think there's a really big danger in that, which is putting all of your eggs in one basket, if you like, and, you know, the first miracle diet that comes along, you're convinced that that's the thing. So I'm definitely going to chuck all of this out. I'm going to stop doing this.
That's
I'm going to change this.
That's something that I've experienced a lot. I spent so much time researching, and I experiment on myself, and I don't go to anyone and say, you need to try my diet. I say it to my brother, but he's the only person I say it to. I don't say, you need to do what I do. What I say is, what I'm doing is working for me at the moment.
Yeah.
I have people, I'm an Instagrammer, and I have people on Instagram when I say I'm having a bad day saying, have you tried the raw food diet? It's the best thing, it will cure you. You should never say that to someone. And I'm not saying to anyone they need to stop taking drugs. Drugs help a lot of people. At a point last year, I wouldn't have been able to stand up if it wasn't for certain medication, and at that time it was what I needed.
I think we should make it clear that obviously we're not suggesting to anybody listening that they should give up their drugs, and if you are thinking about even starting on this journey, then it's really important that you do consult your doctor at every stage of your journey with this. But I mean, Natasha, for somebody starting to research this, which I have to say, after meeting you, I might start thinking about it. I really do have to make some changes to my diet already.
I saw you with that bacon sandwich.
I know. This is my problem.
She brings it all upon herself.
I have no willpower.
So, Natasha, can you open up the jar you brought?
Yeah, what should we start? Where should we start? Are these date balls a good place to start? Are they going to change my mind?
These aren't the ones I normally make, and they're probably a bit warm now, so I don't know, but I usually keep them in the fridge. But I think I'll pass them around.
And we absolutely must give one to Gabriel as
definitely.
Well. Definitely. That's our in-house food
critic.
I don't want to be funny, but it does kind of look like a round ball of poop.
Yes, I make this a South Park reference. I make chocolate brownie balls, and there's a South Park song that is Chef's Chocolate Salty Balls, and I call my chocolate ones that.
I have to admit, I think they look like Virtuous Ferrero Rocher.
Okay, that's what I'm going to think about while I taste this, not, okay,
but there are
not the other idea.
But I think the thing with these is that a lot of people say, how do you have the energy or the time to put together? You're pulling a face.
I'm trying to chew desperately quickly so I can talk well. They taste quite a lot like fruity energy bars.
Yeah, it's essentially what they are.
I think they taste rather good. They're a little...
Thank you.
They're very crunchy.
Yeah.
You can definitely taste a little bit of chocolate in there. It's not too bitter. And I feel like I'm stealing Gabriel's job. Gabriel, over to you. What do you think of it?
Yeah. He's popped the whole thing in his mouth there. Straight in.
I normally do a little hamster nibble. So.
Yeah, I was hamster nibbling, but Gabriel's gone right in there.
They're quite salty, and there is chocolate. You can taste chocolate, salt, and dates, really, are the main tastes.
I have really low blood pressure, so I put a lot of salt in everything. But it's pink Himalayan salt, which has a lot of minerals.
Pink Himalayan salt.
Yes.
I didn't even know there was different colours of salt.
That sounds like stuff that gets seized at Heathrow.
Actually, it's really good for you. Although I have heard
that's
that
probably
it, though,
white
is
Himalayan
pressure.
Salt. But
I've heard tell that ginger is a good food for pain relief. Is that right?
They say that gingers are quite a powerful anti-inflammatory. So a lot of people that I know that are ballet dancers, for example, if they have an injury, they'll drink ginger tea all day. And so for me, I'm in a lot of pain at the moment, so I've been drinking a lot more ginger tea than I normally have. It's also known as an antiemetic, which means that it'll stop making you feel a bit sick. And I know people that when they feel a bit nauseous, they have a cup of tea and it kind of just like knocks the edge off of it. And there are all different foods that have a lot of really amazing healing properties.
But when I pop a joint out, which is, you know, a common part of having EDS, you know, you dislocate quite often. You know, if a joint goes out, I'll head over to my bedroom drawer, take a couple of painkillers, and then pop it back in again. Do you do the same with ginger? Do you pop some ginger in your mouth? And
I didn't take painkillers anyway. I kind of just was like, I just deal with it anyway. So it was kind of...
She's solid. This girl
I'm pretty
hardcore. This girl is solid.
No, it was just that they didn't work for me. And I've been in a lot of pain the last couple of days, and I was kind of in a sphere of desperation. And my mum was like, have some Cocodamol. I was like, I don't know. And I took them because I was in so much pain. And all I felt was sick. It didn't help with the pain. It just made me feel sick. So I'm not saying that you take a certain...
Have you considered morphine? Sorry.
Just be on like an IV drip of morphine. But I think the thing that I say with... I've always said recently with medication is that it helps you with symptoms, but it doesn't help with underlying issues. If you've got something like EDS and you're just very... chronically inflamed, which although it's a very hard thing to quantify, our systems are very overreactive and very inflamed. The food is going to help with that. The medicine doesn't. The medicine might help knock the pain off if you're lucky enough for it to do that. But it's a symptom issue, not a overall body issue.
I've got to get a bit more hardcore, Rob. I think I've got to toughen up a bit.
It's the dairy milk with Oreos and bacon diet.
I know, this is my downfall.
I'm feeling so smug. I've had nothing but sushi and Natasha's lovely
balls.
Salty balls. You're listening to Ouch. This is a disability show, not a cult. Right, now, Mark, one thing that I think we've all noticed is press coverage on mental health. There is more of it than there was a few years ago. Now, our mental health campaign, Rethink, had a campaign called Find Mike. It got an awful lot of press coverage earlier this year, and it just won recognition of the I Wish I Thought of That conference. Chosen
what
as the
great
best
conference.
It's great, isn't it? Chosen as best campaign by people in the fundraising profession. So can you tell us a little bit about this really, I thought, amazing campaign?
There was a guy called Johnny Benjamin, who's a very, very pretty very telegenic young man.
you sound almost unhappy about the fact that he's pretty.
No, I'm not happy. It's very good, which I'll come to later. Not for me. The Johnny Benjamin was in his early 20s, I think, was very unwell. He's got a diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder, and he tried to kill himself one morning. Took himself to, I believe it was Waterloo Bridge. He was going to jump off this bridge, and a guy stopped him and sort of said, "You're all right, mate," and had a conversation with him, took him for a cup of tea or coffee, and that was the sort of turning point. He says that was the turning point in his life, was this guy stopping and helping him. So,
and the campaign emerged from that story.
The campaign emerged from that. So Johnny decided that what would be really cool would be to try and find Mike, because he just wanted to find out who this guy was who basically saved his life, and to sort of tell him, you know, this is awesome, thank you, but also to use that as a sort of wider way of making points about mental health and about where people with mental health difficulties fit in and stuff like that. So he did a film about his project. It was a social media campaign. There was a hashtag on Twitter called Find Mike, and they eventually found him.
Why was it such a good campaign?
I think it's really good campaign because, first of all, it shifted mental health from being a social policy problem to something that you could actually sit down and watch and say, actually, this is one person's story, but not a human interest story in the terms of, oh my God, this is all so terrible, why doesn't someone do something about this? It was one bloke on a journey to do something. So it's kind of an interesting example of what you can do if you stop treating mental health stories as health stories and you shift them into being human interest stories. And that was really interesting. So people kind of get behind this. It's like, oh, it's not a story about schizoaffective disorder. It's about a guy trying to find the person who saved his life. Whoa, brilliant. I mean, people love mysteries. That Sherlock program's tended to be quite popular, I've seen. Set up a mystery like
and
that.
And the twist in the tale being not only were there a lot of fake Mikes, the guy who was found wasn't actually called Mike at all.
I can't remember. What was he called?
I think he was called Neil.
Oh, that's a rubbish name.
Yeah. The campaign wouldn't have failed.
It's not so heroic, is it? Yeah, Find Neil wouldn't have worked. I completely agree with that.
Yeah, it beat lots of other well-known campaigns at this conference that we've seen lately. Some initiated by the public, like the Ice Bucket Challenge and the No Makeup Selfie, you know, picture campaigns. But others which were from organisations such as Movember and Dryathlon. In each case, social media was a big part of leading people towards these campaigns, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And raising lots of money. What are these kind of campaigns a good thing?
I think, right, the Finding Mike thing's different to those campaigns because the other campaigns were really like, they're much like Sit in a Bath of Beans campaigns, which is what we've seen from fundraising. It's interesting, Finding Mike is not about fundraising directly. I think Rethink Mental Illness, as they're now called, the mental health charity, spotted a really good thing. It's like, actually, why don't we stop doing, oh, here's some sad people with mental health difficulties, put on a silly hat and raise some money for them. They spotted that actually what you could do is get people to engage with the issue by seeing a story. So it's not like traditional campaigning. Social media is really, really important in that, because the Finding Mike thing was a story that you could get involved in. You could help. It wasn't like, oh, I pledge my support to the cause, or here's my £10, or I've only got three tins of beans so I can put my foot in a bath of beans.
The way that campaigns go viral on social media now has really changed campaigning, but some of them drive me crazy.
Triathlon, I've never even heard of till this morning.
Well, it's sponsoring people to not drink for a month. I mean,
I'm fed up with people getting sponsored to do things.
I'm not paying you to not drink. Movember, isn't it like, you know, 90% of the guys who take part in Movember do it just to have a moustache on their face and they don't raise any money?
I think it's just a conversation starter, isn't it? Oh, I see you're doing Movember. Like, doing Movember doesn't actually mean raising money anymore.
Can we just do a straw poll around the table? Who knows which charity Movember is collecting money for?
I think...
Do we
who
know?
Do you
Natasha.
Think prostate cancer?
Is it prostate cancer?
Cancer? Is, yeah.
How about the Ice Bucket Challenge?
That was ALS.
Yeah.
Also, the cancer adverts are interesting because they don't tell you anything about really what kind of research is involved.
you don't really learn anything from, you know, if you do the ice bucket challenge, you might do it for Macmillan Cancer, but you don't necessarily learn anything about what the charity does unless you still make an effort and go out and find out.
But this is a big issue for disability. If you look at sort of disability politics going back 20 years, one of the big issues was, could you please stop campaigning on our behalf for things that we don't necessarily agree with? And that's been really subsumed by the industrial engine of fundraising, which a lot of these campaigns are. So, do this, sign up for that, retweet this, oh, it's awareness this, it's awareness that. The question is whether you're raising awareness of the experiences people have and what it means to experience those things, or it's just another tick box to prove to you you're a good person because you grew a bloody moustache.
I mean, is that exactly, is that what social media is turning fundraising into?
I think it's always been that.
But we're much more visible now, aren't we? You know, if you haven't posted a no makeup selfie on Facebook, then people think you're a bad person. If you haven't chucked water over your head, people think you're a bad person. Did you do any of that, Natasha?
I actually got nominated for the ice bucket challenge, and I messaged the girl that nominated me. I was like, I can't touch a cold cucumber without it burning my hands, so I'm not going to chuck ice on myself. But I think there are two arguments with this. One, any publicity is good publicity, and they did make a lot of money. The other side of it is trivialising these things a lot. What I found really interesting is, because I write publicly about my health issues, a lot of people message me and say, I didn't know anything about what was wrong with you, but because you've spoken about it and you've done it in a non-victim way, you've just been very honest about your life. I wanted to find out more about what you're going through. And I think it's that personal connection, and when people really understand the stories and the people behind the illnesses or behind the disabilities, that's the thing that makes the difference. It's not chucking water over your
head. And also, it's the social media gives this new network of support, doesn't it? You know, I've connected with you because of, you know, EDS. I've, you know, followed your journey on Instagram and things like that. I know you because of Twitter, mental health problems. You know, it provides this new way of supporting each other and talking about things.
Absolutely.
That wasn't available before,
Mine's
was
trolls
it?
Trolls as well, of course. Well,
there is also a negative side with that. There is, when I first started getting really ill, I got very much into a lot of the EDS and POTS groups, and they were depressing. They were really depressing, and it made me more depressed as I was going through, because you get caught up in this perpetual cycle of, I'm really ill, I'm not going to get better because everyone here is 30, 40 years older than me and they've done nothing except be ill, and they're complaining about how ill they are and how miserable they are. And like, I don't want to end up like that. And for me, leaving those groups and leaving that side of things was huge for my mental health side of it.
And what's it like for mental health connections?
It's really, really interesting for mental health. Like, social media has created something we haven't had before in mental health, which is the opportunity for lots of people with lots of different mental health difficulties, but also lots of different experiences and ideas to meet on a sort of common ground. So it's kind of like what we had for years and years and years was mental health activism as a kind of party. It might be a squat party, it might be a dinner party, but basically there's some people who are very, very comfortable with who's there. They've been talking with each other, they've been writing papers, they've been aspiring to academia, etc., etc. Social media, first of all, with things like blogs, things like Twitter, things like Facebook groups, what's happened is basically loads of new people have turned up at the party with really, really different ideas. There's always new people turning up at the party.
Yeah.
And that's been really, really fascinating to see. It's been really fascinating to see in mental health that some of the sort of user activists who felt themselves to very much hold the radical ground have seen themselves actually being answered by loads of people saying, well, you don't speak for me. You're talking about a load of issues that I don't understand. It's like, you've come to liberate me from psychiatric depression. I'm in a 3-year waiting list for some treatment I really want. You don't speak for me. And that's been really interesting. So mental health has been quite fractious. There's been quite a lot of arguments. But also, the most interesting thing is just people finding each other and speaking about everyday experiences, which is different from things like forums, because forums have been kind of quite closed communities.
So then you always get quite hierarchical.
Yeah, you get the king of the forum or the queen of the forum, and then anyone new comes along, it's like, oh, well, you don't understand the rules of this forum, you don't know what we know. Whereas social media is wider.
Right, let's go on to the quiz for this month. Shout out if you know the answer for all three of you. So, Kate, first question.
Question number one. It's not the Paralympics and it's not the Royal Tournament.
Invictus Games.
Whoa! Even ask the question. The question was, what's the name of the sports event for the wounded servicemen and women organised by Prince Harry? Natasha?
The Invictus Games.
That is quite right.
Do I get a pin?
We kind of need a ping sound.
But our best wishes.
Okay.
So it featured 400 people from 13 countries competing in events over 4 days at the former Olympic Park. Natasha, did you enjoy the Invictus Games?
I thought that the opening ceremony was really moving, but I think what I find really interesting, and I found this during the Paralympics, is the way that the media reports on games for disabled people, because it turns into almost a fetishization of disabled people, and I thought that the way the people actually involved in the Invictus Games did it was perfectly fine, but then the media is just like, they're so amazing, they're so inspirational, everyone can learn from them, but not everyone is going to be Usain Bolt. It's the same thing. These Olympians, these athletes are extraordinary, and for people to then say to me, oh, maybe if you worked harder you could do something. It's inspiration porn, and I hate it.
Anyone could be a computer programmer or whatever, just by, you know, just because you've heard, you know, on the radio someone who was able to become, you know, in charge of an antivirus company. It doesn't mean that everyone can do it, does it, ever, in whatever the field?
I think it's a bit different from that. I think it's the expectations that kind of coverage gives society about what disabled people can do.
I mean, it's saying that, you know, there is the impression given that any disabled person or anybody could do it. Even those disabled people can do it, so you can do it. Yeah, there does always seem to be a bit of that about it.
We have opened the nest of vipers. And second question. We've turned this into a simple true or false one to just shout out. 25% of guide dogs in London have been run over by a bike. True or false?
Oh, true.
Natasha, you're all wrong. I'm afraid it's false, but you would be forgiven for believing it was true, because this is the figure the Guide Dog Association put out, which then led to a flurry of stories in various news outlets. Later on, the charity admitted they'd given out some rather misleading information, and actually the figure was based on a survey of just 33 respondents. Suffice to say, there are many more than 33 guide dog owners in London.
Are there any better surveys?
Not yet, I don't think. Of those 33, 12 said they had been involved in a collision with a cyclist, 25 said they'd had a near miss, though we got sidelined by the incorrect stats. The main message from the charity was that cyclists should look out and ring their bells.
And I wonder if they asked them if they were run over with or without their guide dog.
Well, indeed, ringing their bells while approaching pedestrians because some visually impaired people are frightened to go out because of cyclists. So, Gabriel, ever been hit by a bike?
Yeah.
How many times?
Once, as far as I can remember.
And what happened?
I was just crossing the road, the lights had changed, and a bike kind of hit me, and the guy said, well, sorry, mate. Unfortunately, it was a non-motorised bike, and he actually did try and make a fair effort at stopping, but, you know, it's still, you know, a bit kind of shocking.
You couldn't see it coming, so you didn't know what was happening, I guess.
No, because it's a bike, they don't make very much noise. And also, the lights have changed, so you don't expect something, you know, unless it's quite a big vehicle, you know, you like to find the lights have changed, so I'll go. You know, there's those spinny things on the bottom of the crossing, the rotating cones.
Yeah.
And Natasha has 1 point, Gabriel has no points, but 1 bike accident, and Mark has no points and no bike accidents.
Yay, I think.
So, next question. Which disability event took place in Belfast recently? Are we all hot on our Northern Irish disability news? No, blank faces all round.
Shall I tell you?
Mm-hmm. It was Disability Pride. For the first time in the UK and Ireland, disabled people took part in a parade through the centre of Northern Ireland's capital city with the message that disability is not a barrier to an active life. It was all organised by Ouch's very own travel correspondent, Michael Holden. So are we proud of being disabled? Are we proud of it? Natasha, what do you think?
I don't relate to being disabled. I don't call myself disabled.
Why is that?
I've been thinking about this a lot. I've always said that I've been chronically ill, and I feel like disability is something of an identity, whereas being ill is something that is almost inflicted on you that I can fight.
Okay, so you'd rather say that you're ill than disabled?
Yeah.
What about you, Mark? Which would you...
I would say that I am disabled because I have a number of cognitive impairments that just won't go away. They always have and they always have done. And I tend to think there's a lot of confusion in mental health about whether mental health difficulties are disabilities, which closes off a lot of potentially useful political avenues for exploring about how we change the situation for people with mental health difficulties. But that's a conversation for another much longer programme, I think.
It's a big topic. Gabriel, are you proud of being disabled?
No, I think being proud of, again, all these things are dependent on what you take the meaning of words to be. But no, I'd say it's absolutely nonsensical to be proud of either being disabled or ill. You work, you do things to negate the things that are a difficulty to you, and being proud, that means, that implies, I'd rather be disabled than not, and it makes no sense.
Does it not mean this is, I'm proud of who I am, and I'm proud of...
Well, you can be proud of who you am without being proud of your disability.
Interesting. This is another big debate, isn't it, Rob?
Yeah. And I don't know. Why would I be?
Yeah, it's not being proud.
I don't think you'd be proud of it, Rob.
Why would I be?
I don't think you'd take part in that.
I'm
march.
Proud of things that I've achieved.
Yeah,
I did
exactly.
not. I did not achieve being visually impaired. I was born with it. Mm. So no, I would not say I was proud.
Yeah, and I don't see how anyone can be.
So next question, why did rapper Kanye West hit the headlines for all the wrong reasons this month?
Wheelchair guys.
Mark just got in there.
Go on then, Mark. Tell us a little more.
As far as I remember, he was asking his entire audience to stand up and get up on their feet. And there were some people who didn't get up on their feet, and he's a bit unhappy, and he sort of hangdog Kanye West way about this. And it turned out those people were in wheelchairs.
You are absolutely on the money there, my friend. Yes, this was at the Qantas Credit Union Arena. That's a sexy name. Sexy Sydney was the place where that's that. I decided I can't do this song, Kanye said during the gig. I can't do the rest of the show until everybody stands up. Unless, he went on to say, you got a handicap pass, his words, not mine,
joyful,
and you get special parking, he added. So thousands of fans were prompted by Kanye to chant, stand up, at the wheelchair user before a security guard confirmed that he couldn't. Fairly embarrassing all round.
Embarrassing, but a bit of a non-story, really. I mean, the guy maybe should have thought, but he didn't know they were in wheelchairs. You know, it's in a great scheme of things. It's
I think he did it every night of his tour. This wasn't the first time this happened. And
okay.
It is Kanye West, who has become an interesting character, shall we say.
Very, very diplomatic.
In recent times.
I used to like him. I'm sure that there's a chorus around the world of people thinking that.
Yeah.
I used to like him. Yeah, I think I'm one of them. So, who's been amassing the points? We don't have our very own, I'm sorry I haven't a clue, Samantha, do we? So I think it was Natasha with one, Gabriel with none, and Mark with one.
I think that's correct.
Is that about right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. And anyway, the fact is there's no prizes because we're not allowed to give any away. So the whole exercise was pointless. But it was fun to play with you anyway.
I enjoyed it.
And that is the end of the... Thank you, Mark. And that is the end of the podcast. Thank you to everybody who's contributed, and also to the team. Emma Tracy, Kathleen Hawkins, and the studio manager, Jill Drabble. The producer was Damon Rose.
Music this month comes from 70-year-old visually impaired artist Chrissy Cochran. Cochran runs a radio station for blind people, The Global Voice, from her home in southwest London. It also plays host to a production company which helps blind musicians get their music produced and marketed online.
And Cochran's latest album is called Not Too Old to Sing a Country Song, and you can get hold of it online. The track we're about to hear is sung by her alter ego, should I say, DJ Soul, which is an electronically treated version of her own voice. It's called Blindness Gets Tedious, Don't It? So until next month,
goodbye.
Goodbye.
The sun comes up the sun goes down. The days of the week keep rolling around. I ain't got sight, but I sure got sound. But blindness gets tedious, don't it? The mailman's knocking on the old front door. My guide dog's asleep on the mat on the floor. He's spark out with his head on his paw, just waiting for me to trip over him. It's around midday, guess it's time for food. I'd better cook something, but I just ain't in the mood. Then I stub my toe and yell out something rude, and spill all that meat and gravy. I clean that up, but my toe still hurts, so I guess I'll settle for a canned dessert. I open it up, and guess what? Spit it all down my shirt. And then find out it's baked beans. Guess it's time we went out for a walk, but I trip over the dog and he lets out a squawk. It's a damn good job that dog can't talk, or he'd be cursing me out something rotten. I clean up the mess of the cold baked beans, and I've read the last of the Braille magazines. Can't even see what's on the TV screen. So what's the point in keeping it? So me and the dog go out for a stroll. It's a good job he's there. I might fall down a hole. But I crack my arm on a telephone pole. It's just one darn thing after another. But we get back home with a bumper or two. Then my dog does something he shouldn't ought to do. Ah, well, I guess I'll just have to clean that up, too. Blindness gets tedious, don't it? I'm telling you, blindness gets tedious, don't it? Yeah, it sure gets tedious, don't it?